pretty closely at what Aquinas is arguing and give you a sense here. Oh, and I should remind you guys, remember I'm gone tomorrow and Friday, but my wife will be teaching class on Friday, and I'll only have office hours, unfortunately, till about 12:45 or so, because I've got a dentist appointment. So if you need to see me between 12 and 12. No, that's absurd. Sorry. And believe me, I'd rather not. I would much rather hang out than any or all of you that go to the dentist. Though I have a nice dentist, but you know, it's just not my idea of a good afternoon. Charlie.
Yeah. Do we turn in the papers in to your
Oh, yeah. You can either you can give them to my wife, or you can turn them into my office, or you can give them to me Monday morning.
Okay.
So whatever works is totally fine. So, yeah, just as always, yeah, I'm not that concerned about the deadline. Just get it in to me. And I'll start grading them probably Monday afternoon.
All right. And so, just slip them under your door like last
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you for that reminder, Scott. Yeah. Always slip them under my door. Don't put them in the box outside. Just they're not. I mean, I can't imagine someone's going to walk around and steal them, but they're not secure if they're there. So under my door they are. You only have to worry about wasps nesting in them or something, and that's I'll deal with that problem. So, but I think we actually got that taken care of, right? We just saw the one dead one yesterday. So, and I stepped on it, which was gross, but there's always a manly, it's like that conflict, it's like I want to kill the thing, but then afterwards, it's like, oh, that was one of God's creatures, that's sad. Okay, but one of those evil creatures, so, okay, sorry. What's that?
Wasp kill spiders.
Yeah, well, exactly. My rule is, if they're outside, leave them alone. If they come inside, they've violated my property rights. Therefore, that's the rule.
It's better to do a state of war instead of the state of nature.
Exactly, exactly. All right, well, let's get going into Aquinas today. I had mentioned just briefly on Monday that Aquinas is this really amazing figure in all kinds of ways, and I'll try and give you a bit of background. If you remember, he was born in 1220, and he dies in 1274. So not a long life, but for that day and age, not a terribly short life either, just right short of 54 years. And in that time period, he really did kind of change the entire course of Western civilization. And yet what he does is not, as we'll see, and I think we've seen this for a lot of these great figures, they don't innovate, they just see. They see what's there, but other people have not been able to see that. So when we talk about Aquinas, we're not really talking about someone who's a great inventor. We're not talking about an innovator. We're talking about someone who has a clear vision of what things are, what they should be, and what they can be, recognizing that what they can be often doesn't happen in this fallen world. So not a lot of hopes here and now, but also not someone who, even though he's a Dominican, and I'll talk a little bit about that, and he lives mostly a cloistered life, he certainly hasn't given up on this world by any means. So Thomas Aquino, right, Tommaso Aquino, was, as I mentioned, born in 1220, dies around 1274. During the time period that he lives, he is from an extremely wealthy Italian family. This is a guy who could have had his life absolutely made for him. Everything would have been given to him. He was a younger brother in this, so he wouldn't even have had to have done the work. He would have just enjoyed the riches. But he felt called to do something else. And yet, he didn't look from appearances, and if we just judge somebody by appearances, he didn't look like someone who would do much in life. He was always hugely overweight. He was slothful in the way that he approached many of the activities of life, not writing, as we'll see, or thinking. But he's not someone that you would pick out and say, oh yeah, this is a guy who's going to do something. This isn't someone who's going to change the world by any means, at least by appearances. And growing up in that rich family, he decided that he wanted to go, and not atypical, he wanted to go into the religious life rather than take on the family business or be a part of it at all. So at the time, and notice the date, they were now getting towards the end of the Middle Ages. But in this time period, it would have been perfectly acceptable for a son or daughter to enter into one of the orders that were well respected. So please remember, orders are, for the Catholic Church, basically what Protestant denominations are for Protestantism. So to be in an order is to be segregated from the church as a whole, but to focus on a certain thing. So I went to Notre Dame, and my professors there were all Holy Cross. They're great. I had good professors. They're not famous for their education, strangely enough, as an order. That's not what they're known for. They're known for doing good works. They're known for helping people, working with the poor. I had, for grade school, I had Dominican nuns. And they were fierce, really, really fierce. Dominicans wear all white all the time. That's how you know a Dominican from another form or order. They always wear white. Sometimes they'll wear a gold belt or something to signify. But the idea of the Dominicans, when they're formed and they are not a respectable order for a family like the Aquinos, the Dominicans are all based on the teaching of St. Dominic. And I'll get to him in a second, but I want to give you the other major order of the Middle Ages that was even more disrespected by the Catholic Church and by mainstream Catholics than these guys were. The earlier order that was formed before the Dominicans was an order called the Franciscans. And the Franciscans are based on the teachings of two very interesting figures. One is St. Francis of Assisi, and we talked about him just very briefly. And the other is St. Clare, his very, very close friend. And so St. Francis, and we can take his story any way we want. St. Francis also was raised in an extremely wealthy family, and he was expected to inherit his dad's textile business. And one day he had such a strong vision in Assisi that he actually stripped down to nothing in the middle of the city, and he threw out his money and just renounced all wealth in the world, and he walked out of town. And you can imagine, this is like the most prominent guy in town. His kid just kind of went wacky. And what Francis does is he walks out into the countryside and he finds a dilapidated church, and he just starts rebuilding it. So it's an old, old church, even in 1200, in the 1100s. It's an old church, and he just starts rebuilding it stone by stone. And pretty soon, a number of his friends, he was well-liked by his friends, a number of his male friends come out, and they start helping him. And they just keep building this church. And they realize at the kind of the end of rebuilding this old stone church that they've got a brotherhood, that they really are fond of each other. They want to make sure that they can promote this idea of always helping the poor and rebuilding the church. So this is a very typical, and this, if you're Catholic or not, we all have strange stereotypes about the power of the Pope. But what happens then, this was very typical, Francis goes to Rome because he wants to start an order, basically a church within a church. And so he goes to the Pope, and he tells the Pope, and there's a ritual. He says, "You are behaving so badly, you're no better than Satan." And this, of course, is all from Jesus telling Peter, "Get behind me, Satan," after he had just sat upon this rock. That's the whole tradition. And the point of the order is that the order is to fix some corruption in the church. That's what an order does. And it does so by example. So the Pope, actually being not a terrible Pope, tells Francis, "Okay, you young upstart fool, if you want to start this order, I grant you the ability to become an order of St. Francis." And that's what he does. So the Franciscans are based then, after they've done this, they're based on the idea, first and foremost, you always help the poor. You renounce wealth and you always help the poor everywhere. Doesn't matter if the poor is homeless or crazy or an alcoholic or a drug addict, you help the poor. That's what the Franciscans do. So we often, and I'm sure many of you had neighbors who had a statue of St. Francis in their garden, we've kind of paganized him. And I'm guilty as well. Any of you walked up to my front, a few of you have, walked into my front yard. I have a huge statue of Mary, and then we have a huge statue of St. Francis. But we also have my favorite. We have a statue of St. Anthony where his head came off. I love that kind of stuff. So he's our headless saint that we keep in the front yard too. Probably not totally kosher, but anyway. Francis is kind of everywhere, and we remember him as kind of the saint of nature, but that's not the proper way. Supposedly he could talk to animals. But what really matters for Francis is that he helped the poor. So the Dominicans then, founded by Dominic, The Dominicans are founded in response to the Franciscans, and what they argue is that the wealthy should not be neglected. That is, that they're so taken with their own worldly pursuits, they probably don't even know much about heaven or Christianity, even if they're giving tons of money to the church. They don't know this. So the Dominicans are formed, and they are specifically formed, their name, and it's still the same. If ever you meet a Dominican after their name, they always put OP, which means Order of Preachers. They're not called Dominicans, actually. That's the slang term. They're OP, the Order of Preachers. And what that means is they were the ones who decided that they would start colleges. They would go around and they would give spontaneous orations in a crowd, but usually to merchants. So they'd walk into a wealthy area and they would proclaim, this is the truth. And they decided, and Dominic was absolutely, yeah, he's a brilliant figure, but he decides that the best way to convert people, the best way, and of course everybody's Catholic, right, if you're in Europe, it's just, are you practicing or not? Is it real or not? So what the Dominicans argue is that you have to be trained in absolute rigorous logic and theology. So you can never privilege one over the other when you're arguing with somebody. And you don't just go beat them blue with your arguments. You have to be persuasive. So much of our oratorical tradition in the West comes from the Dominicans. And they are, yeah, they tend to be within the Catholic Church the greatest of preachers, because that's what they're focused on. If you want to hear a good Catholic priest preach, you want to find a Dominican. So that's the difference between them. Francis focuses on the poor, Dominic focuses on the wealthy. And the Franciscans aren't known for great education, because that's not their focus. They do have, like St. Francis down in Fort Wayne, yeah, they do have colleges. But you don't see them that often. There aren't a lot of St. Francis colleges in the world, because that's not what they do. You see, and I'm sure you've noticed this, if you've looked around in big cities, you'll almost always have a Franciscan hospital. Almost always, because that's what they did. They helped the poor, they went into medicine, and so forth. So that's what they're really known for. The Dominicans are known for great schools, and not in America as much, but in Europe. So Thomas decides he wants to be a Dominican. Now, I just told you a whole lot of stuff about these two orders, partly because I want you to know how the church was structured, but also because I want you to understand that neither of these would have been acceptable to a family of the status of Aquinas. This is like, you're going to do what? Yeah, why don't you become a Benedictine or something normal? And of course, the Benedictines have been around, 800 years at this point? Everybody's used to them. But these are brand new orders when Aquinas is joining. So it would be like, well, again, I apologize, this is really only for the Catholics in here, but it would be like if you just joined some brand, yeah, some guy started an order in 1960 and you're really taken with it, so you join it. Like, well, they're not really tried yet. That's, you know, give them some time. And in my own lifetime, I've seen two orders. Not they started before me, but one has fallen. The legionaries of Christ have just done horribly because they've had all kinds of scandal, pretty new. The other group, Opus Dei, has done extremely well because they tend to be pretty straightforward, pretty honest, and pretty hardworking, both very new in the church. So even though, well, you've got Tom Hanks running around claiming Opus Dei's evil, but it's not. It's just an order of good guys, frankly. So, yeah, Luke.
Are the Knights of Columbus an order?
No, they are a fraternal order, not a religious order, because you're not consecrated if you're in that order. So, but I can, you know, the Dominicans in this area, Ann Arbor, the Dominican nuns, Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, they're huge, the Nashville Dominicans. So it's actually kind of a revival right now, which is interesting, many more than when I was a kid. Yeah, I was a kid right after Vatican II. So the Jesuits, for example, in Vatican II went from 30,000 priests to 3,000 priests in 3 years. That said, they just left. It's like the order basically fell apart. So, you know, these orders can come and go, definitely. And many orders that have existed and done well don't even exist anymore. So, and new ones. So this is just all part of Catholic history, right? Kind of an interesting part. All right, so Aquinas joins. And when he joins, he has to run away from his family because he's not allowed to join a low-class group like the Dominicans. So he goes off to be trained in France. And I'm telling you this. I realize this is all kind of just it might be seen as trivia, but I hope it gives you a sense of who he was. So he goes off to France to study to become a Dominican. And it's hard. It's really hard. You can't just say, I'm a Dominican and be a priest the next day. You have to have very, very, very long education. Franciscans, you don't have to have a lot of education. You're a good guy, you put on the brown robe, and you help the poor, you're kind of a Franciscan. But for the Dominicans, you have to be really trained. And the Jesuits, for example, you can't even be a practicing Jesuit until you're 35, because you have to have two PhDs. That's one of the requirements of being a Jesuit, or the equivalent of two PhDs. So their orders are different. They're very strict about certain things. Okay, so having said that, we'll actually talk about the Jesuits later, because they're so weird, and they're like they're basically the superheroes of their age. In the way, if any of you've seen The Matrix, Neo is dressed exactly. He's wearing a Jesuit robe. That's why his robe he wears. And am I dating myself? Do you guys know The Matrix? Not the first one, but the second, third one. His outfit he's wearing is total Jesuit. We'll talk about that. Even his actions are pretty Jesuitical, except for the sex part. But okay, so all right. So back on Aquinas. Yeah, sorry, just had to throw that in there. I have no idea why caffeine hasn't kicked in yet. Wait till it does. What I'll really be talking about. Okay, so Thomas Aquinas goes off, and his family's so insulted that they get the two oldest sons in the family to go hunt him down. They kidnap him. They sneak into the monastery. They kidnap him. They take him back to their home, and they actually lock him. It's just, like a Disney story, but true. They lock him in the highest tower, and they're not going to let him come out until he's repented of being a Dominican. If he wants to go join another order, that's fine, but he's not going to be a Dominican. And he's up there, and he's sitting in that room, and he's praying, and he's a serious guy. This is not... He's not going to give up easily. He's bullheaded. So I didn't get a chance to tell you, right? I told you he's really big. He's not attractive. He's just not what you'd call a handsome guy by any means. He's got, and this doesn't make him unhandsome, but it makes him distinctive. He's this flaming red hair, which is pretty unusual in Italy. That's more common among the Germans and the Irish, but it's flaming red hair. And he's just, he's a hothead, but he also has this terrible stutter. He can hardly speak sometimes. So a lot of people have just dismissed him. And his nickname was the Dumb Ox. This is what people called him to make fun of him. So he was the Dumb Ox. He can't really speak. Remember, he's going to be an order of preachers. And he can barely speak. He can hardly get three or four words out. And yet, something's obviously going on in his mind. So here he is, locked in this tower. And nothing at all is persuading him that he should leave. So, I mean, if you guys don't mind, I'm just going to read. This is from G.K. Chesterton, who wrote, and it's a little long, but I think you'll like it, and you'll see exactly what Aquinas is like. And I don't think anyone has ever captured Aquinas' character, maybe not his thought, but his character better than Chesterton. And Chesterton, if you guys have ever seen pictures of him, had some of the same physical issues that Aquinas did. I can see them. I can see Chesterton really relating. Do you guys know Chesterton passed away in 1936? One of the before C.S. Lewis, Chesterton was the greatest Christian apologist of the 20th century. Lewis is far better, but of course Lewis didn't get his start until after Chesterton was done. And Chesterton was a huge influence on Lewis. He's a huge influence on everybody. Tolkien. Russell Kirk had one of his huge ballads, The Ballad of the White Horse, completely memorized. So Chesterton's a major, major figure. But he writes this book. Actually, I didn't know what else to do one day, so he wrote a book about Aquinas. And I love this. When his relations tried to despoil him of his friar's frock, he seems to have laid about them in the fighting manner of his fathers, and it would seem successfully, since they abandoned their course. He accepted the imprisonment by his family itself with just composure, and probably did not mind very much whether he was philosophizing in a dungeon or in his monk's cell. Indeed, there is something in the way the whole tale is told which suggests that though a great part of this strange abduction, he had been carried about like a lumbering stone statue. Only one tale tells of his captivity shows what he could really be like when he was angry, and it shows him angrier than he ever was or ever would be. It struck the imagination of its time for more important reasons, but it has an interest here that is psychological as well as moral. For once in his life, for the first time in the last, Tomiso Aquino was full of anger. He was riding a storm outside the tower of intellect and contemplation in which he commonly lived. And that was when his brothers introduced into his room, so remember he's locked in this room, they introduced into his room a very gorgeous painted lady of the night, with the idea of surprising him by a sudden temptation of a prostitute, or at least by placing her in the room, creating some kind of scandal. At this moment, though, his anger was justified and it boiled over. Even by the less moral strict standards of our own day, this was nothing but meanness, and he saw it as much foul as it was expedient. Even on the lowest grounds, he knew what his brothers knew, and they knew what he knew, that it was an absolute insult to any gentleman to suppose that he would break his pledge upon so base a provocation. And he had behind him a far more terrible sensibility, all that huge ambition of humility. I love that wording. He had behind him the huge ambition of humility. Just think about that. That is some fine writing. Just great. Which to him was the voice of God straight out of heaven. And in this one flash alone, we see that huge, unwieldy, red-headed figure in an attitude of activity, or even animation. For he was very animated indeed. He sprang from his seat. He snatched a burning stick out of the fireplace, and he stood brandishing it like a flaming sword. The woman, not unnaturally, shrieked and fled the room as quickly as she could, which, of course, is all Aquinas ever wanted her to do. But it is quaint to think of what she must have thought of this red-headed madman of monstrous stature, juggling a flame and apparently threatening to burn down the house to avoid sin. As he did, however, and she's left, she went out the door, he slammed the door, and barred it back shut. He ran the burning stick into the door, blackened and blistering it until he made one huge sign of the cross. Then he retreated, he dropped the stick back in the fire, he sat down on the seat, and that seat became the scholarship, it became the great chair of philosophy for all time. Now he was sitting in his throne of contemplation, and he would never once more arise. Now, that's incredible, right, to think about that. And of course, yeah, the woman was never in danger, but she was being used, obviously. And here's Aquinas, he's not going to go for this. And don't take this literally, right? Chesterton's not suggesting he never left that seat again. It's a nice, right? So he goes back, and he becomes a great priest. And this is how smart he was. I want you guys to realize what an intelligence this was. You remember, there's no paper yet. No paper at all. So you record whatever you can on whatever you can. Usually sheepskin, but whatever it is that, you know, might be available. Aquinas was so smart that at all times during his waking life, they had to have three monks follow him. Because everywhere he went, he would write books. He would dictate them. So he had monk A, whoever he is, he'd give a whole page or two to him, just like that. And the monk would have to sit there and record it. Then he'd turn to monk B. He's on a totally different book. And Aquinas would dictate where he was on that page in his head to that monk. And then he would go to number three, do the same thing. And by the time he'd gone to all three, he'd be back on number one. And number one would have gotten it all written down. This is what this guy's mind was like. It's unbelievable to think about what he's able to accomplish. And yet again, I want you to remember, he does nothing new. That's what's fascinating about him. Everything he writes is simply a putting together of very old ideas that have either been forgotten or have been neglected. So here's his greatest statement, and I had you guys memorize the first part of this when we were with Aristotle. And this sums up everything for Aquinas. This is what Aquinas is about. Nature makes nothing in vain. But that's not enough. Who's nature?
Hey, what are we talking about here? Yeah, that if you're a pagan, that's great. If you've made it that far, if you're Heraclitus, if you're Socrates, if you're Aristotle, that's fantastic. But by the time you're 1,200 years into Christian history, it's not good enough anymore. Something has to change here. And so what Aquinas does is he takes the statement of Aristotle, nature makes nothing in vain, but only grace perfects nature. So, from Aquinas' viewpoint, God made Nate. He made every one of us. It's not good enough. Now, grace has to make us what we are. So, we have the body, but it's grace that gives us our animation. It's grace that allows us to breathe. It's grace that allows us to think, to love, all of these things. This is grace. And grace is everywhere. It's bouncing around the room right now. It's in each one of us, according to Aquinas. And it has to be claimed. It's not ours. It is a gift. But this is what grace is. Grace is God's love towards us that allows me to breathe right now. It's what allows me to think. It's what allows me to speak. It's what allows me to take a sip of the nectar of the gods here. Coffee. I realized after I said that you might be thinking I'm imbibing or something. I'm not. It's coffee. I mean, all of these things, right, especially. You never know with Catholics, right? I mean, it's just, so, okay. So let's open up, if you guys don't mind, and I want to look at the two arguments that he gives us here. So let's just start with the opening. And please remember, this is after the Magna Carta, and yet it has that same kind of understanding. So let's just start on page 482. And this book here that Aquinas wrote, one of his many, his largest book, is called The Summa, The Sum of All Arguments Ever Made, which may sound pretentious, but he really did. I mean, he's just putting together everything. And I have to tell you this, too. So I don't want to forget about Aquinas. Aquinas is not arrogant. However smart he is, he's not arrogant. And he did at the end, towards the end of his life, and I think it would be unfair to talk about him without saying this, but it's kind of gut-wrenching, actually. So there was a point where he was writing nonstop. I just told you how he wrote, and of course, unbelievable how he was doing that, how he could keep three different books in his head and even know the exact pages that he's on. But, or at least in his imagination, he could. But he also had this moment towards the end of his life. He went to Mass, of course, as a monk and a priest. He would have to go to Mass every day. Daily Mass. It's every priest has to do that, even if it's a private Mass set in home. But he says his Mass, he's in Mass, and he's walking back to his room. So he's in the chapel in his monastery, has Mass, he's walking back to his room, and he walks past a crucifix that he's seen a million times in his life. This thing is part of his architecture, it's part of his vision, but so much that he's always, he's gotten too used to it. It's just there, it's an adornment. And for some reason, one day, he's probably about 48, 49, about my age, and he looks at it for the first time, even though he's seen it a million times, and he collapses, goes into a coma. And when he wakes up, not long, I shouldn't say coma, he's out for a day or so. He collapses, and when he wakes up, he tells everybody, I've had a vision. And God showed me everything I've written, and he told me it was all meaningless. It was straw that will be burned when I die. And he never wrote again. So just keep that in mind, that even he's an interesting guy in every way, and that's a pretty powerful, I think, pretty powerful statement. Okay, so anybody? Emma, you look like you'd be a good Thomistic reader. Do you mind?
Sure.
Okay, so just start at the top of 482.
482? Okay. The way of making truth known is not always the same, and as the philosopher has very well said, it belongs to an educated man to seek such certitude in each thing as the nature of that thing allows. The remark is also introduced by Boethius.
Yeah, you're fine. Yeah, okay. Yeah, Boethius.
But since such is the case, we must first show what way is open to us in order that we may make known the truth which is our object. There is a twofold mode of truth in what we profess about God. Some truths about God exceed all the ability of the human reason, such as the truth that God is triune. But there are some truths which the natural reason also is able to reach, such are that God exists, that he is one, and the like. In fact, such truths about God have been proved demonstratively by the philosophers guided by the light of the natural reason. That there are certain truths about God that totally surpass man's ability appears with the greatest evidence, since indeed the principle of all knowledge that the reason perceives about something is the understanding of the very substance of that being, for according to Aristotle, what a thing is the principle of demonstration. It is necessary that the way in which we understand the substance of a thing determines the way in which we know what belongs to it. Hence, if the human intellect comprehends the substance of something, for example, that of a stone or of a triangle, no intelligible characteristic belonging to that thing surpasses the grasp of the human reason. But this does not happen to us in the case of God. For the human intellect is not able to reach a comprehension of the divine substance through its natural power. For, according to its manner of knowing in the present life, the intellect depends on the sense of the origin of knowledge. And so those things do not fall under the senses... And so those things that do not fall under the senses cannot be grasped by the human intellect, except in so far as the knowledge of them is gathered from sensible things. Now, sensible things cannot lead the human intellect to the point of seeing in them the nature of the divine substance, for sensible things are effects that fall short in the power of their cause. Yet, beginning with sensible things, our intellect is led to the point of knowing about God, that he exists, and that other such characteristics that must be attributed to the first principle. There are consequently some intelligible truths about God that are open to the human reason, but there are others that absolutely surpass its power.
Okay, thank you, Emma. Great job. So there's a lot packed into this, but it's still all summed up in this. Everything, and this is Western Catholic theology from day one, but everything ultimately is sola gratia. Everything is grace alone. That's standard. In some ways, it's a really annoying answer, but it is the answer of the Western Church from day one. Sola gratia. So everything's grace, whether it's our faith or our works, whatever it is, everything is grace at the beginning of it. But this is how we, as fallen human beings, approach the world. We recognize nature makes nothing in vain, and therefore it is really, really important. It's not ephemeral to study biology or botany or physics. These things are all, in a way, the study of God's creation. So there's nothing wrong with those. But when we want to understand the purpose of a higher thing, such as a human being who has free will, we can only recognize the power of grace as animating that thing. So the way that Aristotle had put it and the way that Aquinas takes it is that, yes, we can see through our senses the form of a thing. I can see the form of Frances right in front of me. There are all kinds of things I could do to describe her, and the better artist I am, the better I could describe who she is physically. But in the end, until we encounter one another, until we actually talk, until we see each other in action, until we can see and recognize the grace in me and the grace in her coming together as a grace of friendship, until then, we only know the facts of a thing. So she's a certain height, she's a certain weight, she has this color of eyes, she has this shape of nose, this shape of mouth, this shape of chin, her hair is this length, it's this color. Those are all things the senses tell me that I can record. And that's great, there's nothing wrong with that. Nothing sinful, nothing untoward. It's a fact, lots of facts. But it's what allows us to understand that holds those facts together. That's where we need grace to animate us. That's, we might call it imagination, we might call it grace. But until I see Frances, and I know we have to be careful because in political discourse we talk about objectification and not... There's actually something to that that's deeply, even though the liberals went crazy with it sometimes, there is a point to be made. We are not allowed ever to objectify completely another human being. That's not our job. You know, I can't just say, oh, Frances is an attractive young woman and leave it at that. That is not fair, it's not just, and it's not moral. I have to be able to go beyond that. I have to be able to find out what is it that makes her that way. So this is why, remember when we read the Stoics, remember Epictetus. Of course, I'm going to see a young woman and find her attractive. That's just life. But I can't stop there. And the young woman shouldn't present herself as that's all she is. She has to show as well that she is equally intelligent, equally capable. In other words, she can't allow herself to become merely an object either. And that, and I'm not picking on women, I'm just saying that because obviously I'm sitting here as a male looking out at Francis right in front of me. But it matters for everybody. And this is why, you know, we can't just think of Aquinas as, you know, kind of a fat, redheaded egghead. that's part of him. But that's not who he was. That's not what changed history. That's not what allowed us to understand these things. So we always, in the way that Aristotle and Aquinas would put this, Aquinas being the Christian Aristotle, is you can judge a thing by its accidents. I mean, you can't escape that. First day I walked into the room in this class, I could hardly tell you one from another because you're this mass to me, right? That's, I walk in, I can't take it all in. I knew John. Yeah, I knew Charlie. I'd met a few people. I found out pretty quickly Emma and I have some close friends in common. But I didn't know, you know, I didn't know you guys. And Nate, I found out later, is also very close friends with close friends of mine, but I didn't get that for about a week or two. So there are connections that are there, but you're still a mass to me. And you may be a handsome, pretty mass, but you're a mass. And now think about that. If I walked in today and you were still just a mass to me, well, I may not be that great a teacher at that point. Wait, what's your name? You know, I mean, okay, that was okay on week two. In week 10, that's pretty bad, right? And so here we are. Right? We've got to think about these things. And so it can't just be the accidents. It can't be that. We have to figure out the essence of a thing. And this is really, it's the difference between being trained in something and being educated. Being educated means you understand the thing, not just the facts of the thing. That we can train anybody to know the facts of the thing, but to understand the essence. So even though we're only, Emma just read three paragraphs, bless you. Yeah, even though that she just read three paragraphs, there's so much in this. And I'm hoping, even though I told you the story of Aquinas and the prostitute, which I'm guessing you won't forget just because it's a pretty weird story, one reason I tell it, I think it also says something, but you'll remember that. Oh yeah, that guy. Right? You're not going to forget Aquinas. But we now know his essence a lot more. There we saw some action. Now we know his essence. And that's everything for Aquinas. It's not enough just to judge. We can do that very easily. We can dismiss people, we can have crushes on them, we can be infatuated, we can think they're the ugliest thing we've ever seen, but in the end, that doesn't really matter. What matters is how they act, what they do, how good they are, how good they make others around them, and that's what Aquinas is saying. So, there's always nature. Nature makes us. No one in here is made without purpose, but it's only the grace of God that allows us to become what we are truly meant to be. So from this argument, Scott will never be, no matter how great he is, he will have limits if he relies on his own will. Now he may be such a great guy with such a strong will that he may do amazing things like Alexander the Great. I hope you're not another Alexander, but you know, you might. But you won't really become fully you until you've been filled with this goodness of grace. That's Aquinas' argument. So, here's another thing we can know then. And imagine this. And I guess I could open this up, but I'm assuming we'd all probably agree. I mean, look what he says in that second paragraph. How do we know something? All right, let's take the most important thing for Aquinas that we would know. We know there's a God. Well, even Socrates and Plato got that one right. You just have to be reasonable. There's a way that we can be reasonable that says, all right, here's God. Makes sense. Makes sense that we wouldn't have a million different gods or even five different gods. Because if he's God, He's omnipotent. That's it. There's only one omnipotence. You can't have two omnipotent beings, or they're not omnipotent. So even the pagans got that right, and power to them. But how could any one of us in this room explain the Trinity? How could we explain three in one? How could we explain the equality of God the Father to God the Son to God the Holy Ghost? There's no one in this room that can do it. There's no one who's ever lived outside of Jesus who could do it. You just can't. I don't care if you're the smartest guy in the world, smartest young woman in the world, doesn't matter. You can't do it. And yet, you can't be a Christian and not believe it. And so that's what Aquinas is saying. All right, there's certain things, a lot we can know. There are other things we just have to accept on faith. And that's one of them. No logic in the world will get you to a triune God. It's just not possible. But faith will get you there. That's grace. And that's where he's coming from. So keep that in mind as he's thinking about this. Okay, so are there any questions about this at all? Any thoughts? And feel free to speak up whether you like this or not. Not a problem. Okay. All right, well, let's jump forward then to, just for a moment, to page 485. And let's look at this. So, how far do we want to go here? Oh, yeah, this is important. Okay, who wants to read? Emma, thank you for reading. Who else would like to read? Anybody? Yeah, Nate, thanks. Just start there at the bottom. Now, perhaps some will think.
Now, perhaps some will think that men should not be asked to believe what the reason is not adequate to investigate, since the divine wisdom provides in the case of each thing according to the mode of its nature. We must therefore prove that it is necessary for man to receive from God as objects of belief even those truths that are above the human reason. No one tends with desire and zeal towards something that is not already known to him. But, as we shall examine later on in this work, men are ordained by the divine providence towards a higher good than the human fragility can experience in the present life. That is why it was necessary for the human mind to be called to something higher than the human reason here and now can reach, so that it would thus learn to desire something and with zeal tend towards something that surpasses the whole state of the present life. This belongs especially to the Christian religion, which in a unique way promises spiritual and eternal goods. And so there are many things proposed to men in that transcend human sense. The old law, on the other hand, whose promises were of a temporal character, contained very few proposals that transcended the inquiry of the human reason. Following the same direction, the philosophers themselves, in order that they might lead men from the pleasure of sensible things to virtue, were concerned to show that there were in existence other goods of a higher nature than these things of sense, and that those who gave themselves to the active or contemplative virtues would find much sweeter enjoyment in the taste of these higher goods. It is also necessary that such truth be proposed to men for belief so that they might have a truer knowledge of God. For then only do we know God truly when we believe him to be above everything that it is possible for man to think about him. For, as we have shown, the divine substance surpasses the natural knowledge of which man is capable. Hence, by the fact that some things about God are proposed to man that surpasses reason, there is strengthened in man the view that God is something above what he can think.
Okay, let's go ahead and stop there. Though the next paragraph's really important, but we're running out of time, and I want to mention two things. Thank you, Nate, very much. So we'll pick this back up. I'll have somebody will remind my wife on Friday to start right there. I'd really appreciate it. So, okay, let me just two things, and we'll end here, because I want to make this, I think, as something important as well. So there are a lot of ideas, obviously. I mean, we've skipped a lot of the Middle Ages, right? We went from the beginning to the end, and we'll go back a little bit too. But as we look at Aquinas, every single thing that he's saying here, everything is related in some way to the incarnation. So all real grace, all fulfillment, all understanding is given to us, not that we can know all things, but what we do know is from the light of the Logos. So because of the incarnation, there's certain things we can know about man that could not have been known without the incarnation of Christ. So that Logos becoming flesh is really important. And that's, you know, just the, especially the two last two paragraphs, well, I guess you read two paragraphs, the two paragraphs that Nate reads here, those are all really an explanation of what grace comes out of the incarnation. And it allows us to understand great things, but never the greatest thing. God will always be a mystery to us. Even maybe a beautiful, hopefully a beautiful mystery. Okay, but here's the second thing, and I'll have my wife talk a little bit more about this. But everything that Aquinas is doing here is baptizing Aristotle. So Aristotle, unlike Plato, had been lost to the West. Plato has never been lost. We've always had the Platonic dialogues. But Aristotle, right around the time of the collapse of the Jews, and it had nothing to do with that, but the collapse of Judaism around 7 AD, from that time period up until about, well, the Crusades, actually, we didn't have Aristotle in the West. We had a few quotes from him. Boethius, in fact, had quoted Aristotle. But we had no texts of Aristotle. And the Muslims had used them very, very effectively. So they had all the texts of Aristotle. And it wasn't until we captured Jerusalem that we were able to find some books of Aristotle, and they're brought back. When they're brought back, though, into the West, they always have with them Muslim commentaries. So all of our Aristotle's translated by the Muslims. And when it comes into the world, back into the Western world, it's seen as a great threat because of how much it focuses on reason and what we can know. So it's Aquinas, more than anyone else, who takes these, what were perceived as kind of Islamic Aristotelian writings, and makes them Christian. Right? And that's critical. So I'll just end with this, and I'm sorry I'm taking you guys over 2 minutes, but one world historian who was Jewish, not at all Catholic, but he makes the point, had Aquinas not baptized Aristotle, we would not have modern Western civilization. Islam would have defeated the West very clearly. And I don't think that's an exaggeration. I think that's how powerful Aristotelian thought has been for us as a Western people, for it to come back. Okay, I know, what a loaded thing to end with. But we'll pick this back up on Friday, or my wife will. Thank you guys so much, and have a good Wednesday and Thursday, and I'll see you on Monday.